From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And today's January jobs report was strong, employers adding 227,000 jobs, the most in 4 months. It includes data from when President Obama was in office and continues an overall upward trend. But it's the first report released under the new Trump administration. So what will President Trump do with the economy he's inheriting? Well, for one thing, he's ordering a rollback of the Dodd-Frank regulations put in place after the financial crisis. Michael Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News. He joins us now from New York. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Robin.
And let's start there with Frank Dodd. It spawned the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. It has requirements about banks having capital on hand. There's the Volcker Rule, kind of limiting banks, you know, gambling with money. Remind us what Frank Dodd did.
Oh, all those things and more. I mean, obviously, it really put a lot of new restrictions. It really reshaped Wall Street in many ways. And there was a bit of a backlash against it. A lot of people in the industry believe that it has caused banks to sort of hoard money rather than lend it out to businesses that could use it. And there's a great debate about every, you know, nook and cranny of this law, which ones should be preserved and which ones should be remain. It sounds like the administration is going to basically attack all aspects of the law. That's according to Gary Cohn, who was the former president of Goldman Sachs and is now one of Trump's top economic advisors. He said that to Bloomberg today. Basically, they're going to, you know, go after pretty much every aspect of the law.
Well, and Trump's Treasury Secretary nominee Steve Mnuchin, the former Goldman Sachs partner, says he wants to overturn the Volcker Rule. But there's another part of Dodd-Frank called the Cardin-Lugar Amendment. What did it call for, and why is there a call for repealing that?
Yeah, this is basically a rule that would require energy and mining companies to disclose the payments they're getting from foreign governments. And the intent behind it was to try to prevent corruption, basically try to stop these leaders of poor countries from basically stealing the money earned from oil and mineral sales. And so what it did, it required companies listed on U.S. stock exchanges to disclose any tax payments, any royalty payments being made around the world. And there was a big backlash from the energy industry specifically against it. There was a long court battle that stalled the implementation of it for many years. And their argument was that it hurts the competitiveness of U.S. companies when they're competing against foreign companies that don't have to abide by rules like this.
Yeah. Well, there are huge critics of repealing it. Democratic Representative Maxine Waters says if you roll this back, it'll benefit companies like ExxonMobil, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, former CEO of that company. So some people are seeing this as kind of, you know, backslapping. But what can the president do? Can he really roll it back, or can he order that his Treasury Department do it?
Well, you know, with each of these orders he's signing today, there's certain things he can do and certain things that must go through Congress. So, you know, there's bound to be, as you said, there's bound to be a huge backlash against pretty much everything announced today. You know, Senator Warren especially will be very vocal about the Dodd-Frank changes. And, you know, I would expect a very stiff opposition to pretty much all of these plans.
Right. Well, Donald Trump also wants the labor secretary to revise or remove the fiduciary rule. This is supposed to take effect in April, and it's supposed to protect consumers in retirement plans, to eliminate conflicts of interest when a broker might get a commission for steering an investor into a fund, even if it's not good for that investor. So there's a call to roll that back. And Congress is already rolling back regulations without executive order. This week, the Senate approved a resolution passed by the House to repeal a rule that prevented mining companies from dumping waste into streams. You know, Donald Trump has promised to revive the coal industry. Will that revive the coal industry if it's not allowed to pollute? I mean, is that cost effective?
Well, you know, the critics of this will argue that this is basically putting a big chunk of the mining industry out of business, surface mining particularly.
Requiring them not to dump in clean waters.
Right. Which I guess, you know, we can all argue, you know, the merits of that particular aspect of it. But, you know, the argument is, and again, remember, Trump had a big backing of support from the coal mining regions of this country. So this is, again, one of those campaign promises that he seems to be delivering on.
Well, and those in support of repealing that rule that you can't dump in clean waters say that it will keep jobs in those coal areas. So we'll continue to watch this. Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, today the U.S. Treasury Department announced sanctions against about 24 individuals and companies following Iran's announcement that it conducted a ballistic missile test earlier this week. It is the first official action taken after President Trump tweeted earlier this week that Iran had been put on notice. The president also tweeted this morning, quote, "Iran is playing with fire." Just part of a big foreign policy week in Washington. And joining us for more on that is Michelle Kellerman, NPR correspondent covering the State Department. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, nice to be here.
And what more do we know about these Iran sanctions and the administration's posturing toward Iran?
Well, basically, what the Trump administration did was they added more names to a sanctions blacklist. Under previous executive orders, they listed companies and individuals in Iran, the Gulf, and in China that are allegedly involved in Iran's ballistic missile program. Now, Jeremy, officials point out that this is not a violation of the nuclear deal with Iran. The U.S. has always said that it's going to push back on provocative behavior from Iran, including ballistic missile tests. And this is precisely what the Trump administration did. I would say what's new here is the speed with which the administration acted. The U.S. ambassador to the U.N. also had urgent consultations earlier this week in the Security Council after this Iranian missile launch.
The U.S. ambassador to the U.N. being Nikki Haley, former governor of South Carolina, who also made some comments at the U.N. yesterday about Russia and its involvement in Ukraine. Let's listen.
We do want to better our relations with Russia. However, the dire situation in eastern Ukraine is one that demands clear and strong condemnation of Russian actions.
She went on to criticize Russia's actions in Crimea. So what do you make of this, Michelle? And what happened to the idea of, as she said, trying to better the relationship with Russia?
Well, I think they do want better relations with Russia, especially when it comes to fighting ISIS. But there's been this flare-up of fighting in eastern Ukraine that, you know, the U.S. had to respond to. And both Haley and Secretary of State Rex Tillerson were pretty tough on Russia when it came to Ukraine during their confirmation hearings. On the Crimea specifically, she said that, you know, Crimea-related sanctions are going to continue until Crimea is returned to Ukraine. But I would note that there are other sanctions, Jeremy, that are related to Russia's actions in eastern Ukraine and meddling in U.S. elections. She was careful not to mention those, so maybe we can see some wiggle room ahead.
It'll be interesting to see what happens with that, given all of the talk that there has been about improving relations with Russia. Also, Michelle, yesterday the Trump administration released a statement on Israel, surprising to some, saying, quote, "While we don't believe the existence of settlements is an impediment to peace, the construction of new settlements or the expansion of existing settlements beyond their current borders may not be helpful in achieving that goal." Is that a tougher statement on Israel than people were expecting from the Trump administration?
I think it is. But let's remember that the statement was put out after Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu suggested that he would okay new settlements. That's something that hasn't happened in many, many years. So the White House seems to have been responding to that and making sure that while it doesn't see settlements as an obstacle to peace, it also doesn't want to green light a major expansion of what's already there. But even with this caveat, Trump's approach is a big change from the Obama administration. Under Obama, the U.S. criticized all settlement activity on land that Israel captured in 1967. These are areas that the Palestinians seek for a future state, and President Obama was always clear that it was a problem in peace negotiations.
There was also some drama this week about a phone call the president, President Trump, had with the Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull. The Washington Post reported that the call turned sour. Now Trump is calling that report fake news, and the Australian Prime Minister said the conversation ended courteously. What do we know? Was there a dispute? Was there a touchy phone call between these two world leaders?
Well, there is a dispute over this arrangement that the Obama administration made with Australia, and that is to resettle over 1,200 refugees who tried to make it to Australia but were shipped off to these Pacific Island nations where they've been languishing in what we're told is pretty awful conditions. The State Department, after this phone call, did say that out of respect for Australia, they called it a friend and an ally, the U.S. will honor the agreement. But it also doesn't mean that all these people are going to show up right away. These refugees still have to go through the careful vetting that the U.S. already has in place. And remember, Trump's executive order has put the refugee program on hold for the time being, with some exceptions when it's in the national security interests.
Michelle, just a few seconds left, but how are people, you've been covering the State Department for many years, how are people there responding to Rex Tillerson, the new secretary?
Well, I think there's just relief that there's somebody here on the job, because this, you know, the executive order on refugees and visas came before he was here and before the State Department knew that they had a man in place to be able to deal with things like this.
That's NPR correspondent Michelle Kellerman, who covers the State Department. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you've seen Rogue One, a Star Wars story, one of the most surprising digital special effects is that Peter Cushing, who died in 1994, appears as Grand Moff Tarkin, the character he played in Star Wars in 1977. It's a digital recreation, and it has raised some legal questions in Hollywood about an actor's publicity rights after their death. Joining us now via Skype is Joe Rothberg, who is an attorney with Brutskus Gubner in Los Angeles. Joe, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what are the publicity rights and what are the legal rules about digitally recreating an actor or celebrity after their death?
So that actually depends a lot on what state you are living in and what state you were living in at the time of your death. Publicity rights allow individuals to control their name, voice, signature, photographs in connection with commercial use. In this case, it would be a film. And certain states are very protective over those rights. Certain states are not as protective. Certain states have enacted laws that let these publicity rights survive death. So states like California, where there's a lot of celebrities, actually Tennessee is a good example because of Elvis's estate, and Indiana, which is home to or was home to James Dean, I should say. So it allows states that enact those postmortem rights allow descendants of a deceased celebrity to control the use of a celebrity's image for a certain amount of time after their death.
And has this come up a lot? I'm wondering if this even happened before we had the technology to deal with digitally recreating somebody who's no longer alive.
Yeah, it's actually, it comes up every now and then on almost a 7-year cycle, it seems. My favorite example from a while ago was actually a Super Bowl commercial, if you remember, that had Fred Astaire, or digitally recreated Fred Astaire, dancing with a dirt devil. And everybody thought, oh, wow, now we can just have all these celebrities that have been deceased come back. Some states strengthened their postmortem laws after those started coming out. But we hadn't really seen someone to the extent of, I guess you'd call it Peter Cushing's resurrection in Star Wars. As a spoiler, I guess I should warn people, but he was a big part of the movie. He had a lot of lines.
Yeah.
So that's, I think, why people have really started reconsidering what the situation is in terms of the ability to control your image after you're gone.
And by the way, Lucasfilms has already come out and said that they're not planning to do that with Carrie Fisher in any future Star Wars films, because people were wondering whether they would try to put her in, digitally recreate her image into a future Star Wars film. They say that that is not in their plans at the moment. What about the case of Marilyn Monroe? Tell us what happened there.
Yeah, so the estate of Marilyn Monroe got into a pretty big legal fight a couple years ago. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals finally ruled on it in 2012. And the fight actually ended up being about where Marilyn Monroe was domiciled at the time of her death. And as I said before, different states have very different laws and regimes about what kind of rights you might have after death. California is very strong. New York is not very strong. And the court decided that she was in fact domiciled in New York at the time of her death. Domiciled is a fancy legal term for saying you were living there and you intended to permanently live there. And because of that, her heirs could not use the California Civil Code's Postmortem Celebrity Rights Act to control her estate. So, I mean, when you have someone like Marilyn Monroe, who's on all sorts of T-shirts and merchandise still, there's a lot of money in it. And the right to control those property rights is, you know, you're talking big business.
So what if you're not dealing with the death of an actor, but rather the studio decides that they want to make a sequel, the actor's not into it, and they say, okay, well, we'll just digitally recreate you into it. Is that
sure?
Is that something that happens or could happen?
That would be much more difficult to do because while not a lot of states have enacted a postmortem right to publicity, many states, including California, where all the studios are, there's a very strong protection for your right to publicity in the here and now. So if somebody just tries to use your likeness as part of a commercial enterprise without your consent, you'd be able to use California Civil Code 3344 to try and contest that.
Hmm. So do you expect a lot of actors are going to be writing new wills or contracts at this point to make sure they're protected?
I think it's something they're thinking about a little more. What's going to be interesting, I think, is if the union decides to weigh in on this. Not everybody – I mean, in California, there's a time limit to how long your publicity rights last after death. So like a copyright, you can basically phase into the public domain. And I think it's going to be interesting to see if studios realize they can make or if they can make a great deal of money off, I don't know, recreating Napoleon or something of that effect and kind of cutting actors out of the deal-making process.
Hmm. Well, I do remember Bill Clinton in the movie Contact, and he wasn't actually, you know, acting for the movie, but they placed him in there and put Jodie Foster there with him, even though they weren't together in the same room, and that brought up a lot of questions.
Yeah, and they did that in Forrest Gump, too. I think the difference there being that that was use of archival footage, which you've already kind of relinquished over, and there might be a fair use argument there.
That's Joe Rothberg, who is an attorney with Brutskis Gubner in Los Angeles, taking on some of the challenges of the future, although the future may be now in some cases. Joe, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, that was a nice break from politics, wasn't it? And a rare one. Even the Super Bowl is no refuge. Boston Papers feature stories today about some Patriots fans making the painful decision to not back their beloved team because the coach, the owner, and the quarterback have all supported President Trump. And Fox TV will have an interview with the president before the game with Bill O'Reilly, who's also interviewed President Obama in 2011 and 14. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans has some thoughts. He's here. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
And this is, as you pointed out to us, this is a tradition. The network that has the game also has an interview?
Yeah, we've seen this before, and some of them have been highly anticipated. He may be asked a few substantive questions about the news of the day, but generally these interviews are not all that remarkable. But given that it's Donald Trump and he can be unpredictable, you never know what might happen.
Right. Well, people who've had their fill of politics— maybe looking elsewhere, and you were part of a critic survey by the website IndieWire about what shows people should watch maybe to alleviate some of the political angst they might have on either side of the political aisle. So what were the findings?
Well, what's interesting about this moment in media and culture is that everything seems to have a political tinge to it. So it is tough to consume mass media and also find corners of it where you can maybe get away from some of the political conflict. But I think it's important for people to have a healthy media diet and to moderate their consumption of some of the political conflict that we're seeing in late night talk shows and on cable television and in news. So, you know, I mentioned NBC's family drama This Is Us, which I've always been a fan of. Other people have talked about shows that are even more escapist, you know, sci-fi shows like maybe Colony on the USA Network, where you're seeing people in a distant future that maybe might take your mind away. But, you know, even a show like Colony is about, you know, a world that has been sort of dominated by an oppressive alien regime. So even shows that you don't necessarily think would have a resonance with today's political conflict can resonate in ways that you don't expect.
Well, you recommend the show The Good Place, the NBC comedy starring Kristen Bell and Ted Danson. It's in the afterlife. Danson plays an architect sort of who's designed a perfect world, supposedly only meant for the best of the best. But then Bell's character ends up there by accident. I want to hear a little. Here's Bell's character, Eleanor, realizing there's someone else in this afterlife who's also imperfect. Let's listen.
You crashed your jet ski into a manatee?
Yeah. I'm from Jacksonville, Florida. That happens a lot.
What did you do for a living?
I was an amateur DJ. I was also an amateur hip-hop backup dancer, an amateur body spray inventor. I did pranks on Vine.
None of those are jobs. What did you do to make money?
Oh, I sold fake drugs to college kids.
Okay.
I mean, that's appealing right there, but why else do you like this show?
Well, you know, if you want to give the highfalutin NPR answer, it's that The Good Place is sort of this absurdist, really comic meditation on what does it really mean to be a good person and how does someone who's been selfish their whole life figure out how to discard a lot of that and become someone who is selfless when their goal is kind of selfish, which is to stay in the good place. So it sounds like a mouthful, but it's a fun show. Ted Danson's amazing in it, too. But it toys with some very interesting and ultimately serious questions.
Okay. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans with some thoughts about politics and television viewing. Eric, thank you.
Thank you.
And Jeremy, it's occurred to me, I used to rave about a show that I finally decided to watch, binge watch, and I have chosen the exact wrong time to binge watch House of Cards. Because if you want to get away from political intrigue, that's, of course, the story that's all about in political intrigue.
And it's a great show, and you will enjoy it thoroughly. I just finished, as Eric knows, I'm a little behind the curve on some shows, but I just finished The Night Manager, which is fantastic, and have now moved on to Atlanta, which is also great.
Okay, so what
lots
are you
of shows to
Yeah,
see.
There's lots to see. What are you doing out there to sort of get away from what's in the ether, the news? Let us know at hereandnow.org.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you everything you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come pre-measured, so there's no food waste, and it's delivered right to your door. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying seasonally inspired recipes and exploring new flavors and cuisines. No commitment. Get the meals only when you want. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/here.
A nonprofit in Pittsburgh is pioneering what's being called the Uber of food recovery. The group has created a new app that keeps excess food out of the dumpster and puts it into the hands of people in need. Kara Holsoppel of Here and Now contributor The Allegheny Front reports.
Hey, Jennifer England spends a lot of time on the phone.
Homewood? Okay, great. All right, thanks so much.
She's director of operations for 412 Food Rescue, and she and her staff connect places like food distributors, which have, say, an extra crate of oranges, to shelters or other groups where people need food. It's mostly fresh food, and they have a refrigerated truck to make it happen.
In the past year, we've rescued over 750,000 pounds of food, and that's a drop in the bucket.
England says her group is designed to prevent good food from falling through the cracks.
A tray of deli sandwiches that was made for a catering order by mistake, or a couple of pans of leftover restaurant food. And that's a really small amount to send a truck for. That's actually kind of wasteful.
And that's where Food Rescue Hero, the app, comes in. England says with it, a network of over 450 volunteers can be notified instantly when there's a perishable food donation.
Okay, so I just entered that there's a donation for pickup at Whole Foods. And now I'm going to create a match, basically telling the volunteer where the food is going.
Only one volunteer has to answer the push notification on their mobile device. Today, it's Shannon Baldridge. He's accepted this assignment, and the navigation on his phone guides him here to Whole Foods. Now he's searching for the garage door at the side of the store.
She said ring a doorbell, but I don't know.
Baldridge works from home in marketing and web design, so he's an ideal candidate for this mid-morning run. Inside the loading dock, an employee pushes a cart stacked with six boxes up to Baldridge's hatchback.
We got some veggies and some mushrooms, some asparagus, strawberries.
Baldridge slides the food into the back seat and uses the app to show he's picked up the donation. Now he's ready for the next leg of the trip.
It's amazing how much food gets wasted, right? Yeah.
An estimated 40% of food in the U.S. It ends up in landfills, producing methane gas and contributing to climate change.
Seeing that, and then you end up on the other side of it, people going hungry. It's like, it's crazy to think about, you know?
Baldridge is directed by the app to drive just 2 miles to a public housing complex where staff are waiting to help him unload.
I'll just bring it in. This is my favorite part.
This is your favorite part? Why?
Just, you know, mission accomplished. You know, make that connection.
Michelle Sandage with Pittsburgh's Housing Authority says the food will certainly not go to waste here or at their other sites. In the past, each month they would have at least 5 to 7 families who were without food. This year,
since 412 has entered into our lives, we have not had one call for emergency activity for food distribution because everybody really is well taken care of.
Back at 412 Food Rescue headquarters, Jennifer England says they're still working through some snags with the app, but eventually...
The volunteers can expect at this point to get pinged maybe 5 times a day, probably... Long term, it's going to be much more than that, though.
England says they're also planning to scale up the project so other cities can take advantage of this technology and make an impact on food waste and hunger. For Here and Now, I'm Carol Holsoppel in Pittsburgh.
Is Steve Bannon the second most powerful man in the world? Time magazine asks that question this week in a cover story about the White House chief strategist who's been described as aggressive and brash. Time editor-at-large David Von Draley wrote the piece and joins us from Kansas City. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And first of all, aggressive and brash are actually nice words that have been used to describe Steve Bannon. He's also been called a white supremacist, including by the House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi and many others. What's true?
Well, aggressive is definitely true. Brash, I think, is true some of the time. He can be extremely charming. So if you were to YouTube his name, you'd find some speeches where he is very winsome. White supremacist, I think, is I haven't found the evidence for that. But has he at Breitbart, particularly where he's executive chairman or was until recently, have they exploited the energy of white supremacists? Yes, they have.
What about anti-Semitic? Is that true about him?
I don't think so. I think he enjoys shocking people and will say outrageous things about all sorts of groups, including groups that he belongs to himself. This is a man that I don't think until very recently pictured himself necessarily being part of a presidential administration. And so he's not a person who's spent his life preparing for, a Senate confirmation hearing.
Well, how did Steve Bannon and Donald Trump link up with each other?
Through a very wealthy conservative family from Texas called the Mercers, Robert and Rebecca Mercer. They're major donors to the Tea Party movement, which Bannon became a champion of after the financial crisis of 2008. They brought Bannon into Breitbart.com, right-wing media platform, after the death of the founder, Andrew Breitbart. It needed leadership. They were major shareholders. And Bannon made Breitbart a major platform for Trump's campaign. And when the campaign in August of last year was floundering and needed leadership, the Mercers suggested to Trump that he should bring in Bannon.
And right now it appears that they're pretty close. They're kind of on the same page about a lot of things. How tight is their relationship, Trump and Bannon?
Trump is interesting. He's famous for, he likes to have competing groups around him, vying for his attention, proposing alternative ideas. He likes what might, you know, generously be called creative tension in his group. And Bannon speaks to one part of Trump. On one side, he's a very practical businessman, a kind of a can-do, fix-it sort of person. In the other side, he pictures himself leading a movement, being a historical figure who is going to really significantly change the Western world. And that's Bannon talking. That's the Bannon side. In that half of Trump's brain, Bannon occupies a huge amount of space.
Well, what exactly does he want to do? Because you write that Bannon is in it not for the money or position, but to change history.
Exactly. And that is what makes him so unusual. He's very wealthy. He, in a little deal way back in his history, he got a small piece of the proceeds of Seinfeld, the TV show. And he has this idea that every 80 years or so, the world goes through a major turning. A huge crisis comes, and everything, all the institutions of the past are washed away, and new institutions are created. The American Revolution was a turning. The Civil War was a turning. World War II was a turning, and he thinks that the cycle is happening now and that he and Trump are going to be instruments of it.
And does he believe that a war is coming?
That's the big question. He said at Breitbart he had a radio show, among other things, and let's stipulate that talk radio sometimes has to, you know, be provocative to gather and keep an audience. But he has said on that radio show that he sees a shooting war in the Middle East coming. He sees a war in the South China Sea as inevitable. Obviously, either one of those things is a big deal. And I think it's reasonable for the American people to, you know, look for some clarification. Was that provocative radio talk, or is that really what he sees as necessary?
Well, he, Steve Bannon, declined through a White House spokesperson to speak with Time for this story, but you were able to learn quite a bit about him from people who have worked with him. What did they have to say about him?
He has some really big fans. He's clearly very intelligent. He's creative. He's a forward thinker. He also, by all accounts, has a volcanic temper and can be abusive. He's a very hard charger, a hard worker. He starts earlier and works longer than most other people. He's had a number of different careers. He's been in the Navy. He's been an investment banker, both at Goldman Sachs and on his own. He's been a movie producer. He's been a website provocateur. And now he's the chief political strategist for the President of the United States. He's succeeded at every one of them, which gives you the idea of a very unusual, very creative, very intense man.
Do you get a sense of what the power dynamic is between him and Kellyanne Conway and Reince Priebus, the chief of staff?
My sense is that they're highly competitive with one another. I think they all respect each other. Reince Priebus is he was chairman of the Republican Party. He's come up through the Republican Party. He is a party guy, and he's knows how to operate in Washington. Steve Bannon was born a Democrat, became a Republican. Then in the financial crisis of 2008, really adopted a pox on both their houses kind of attitude, that both the parties are complicit in everything wrong in Washington, and they both need to be brought down. And so he's much more of an outsider than Kellyanne or Reince.
One more thing I want to ask you about. You write that the key to understanding Bannon is to understand what happened to his dad, Martin Bannon. What happened to his dad?
Steve Bannon comes from a working-class family in Richmond, Virginia. His dad worked for the telephone company, first as a laborer, worked his way up into management, and, you know, had a little nest egg after raising five kids. And the financial crash of 2008, very nearly wiped him out, as it did so many people. And Bannon had come from the banking industry, from Wall Street, and understood how it operated. And he really blames the crisis primarily on the unreasonable risk-taking by the banks. And he looked at his father paying the price for this crash and his former colleagues getting off kind of scot-free. You know, in this way, he's sort of, on the Bernie Sanders side of the analysis, where are the bankers going to jail? Where are the bankers losing their homes? And after that, he became, we got to bring this whole system down sort of guy.
So should we assume then that he had nothing to do with the selections of people like Steven Mnuchin and Gary Cohn and all of these Wall Street people being put into the Trump administration?
Yeah, I think we should assume that. This is the evidence that as influential as Bannon is, he's not the president. He's not a puppeteer pulling strings. Donald Trump is the boss and has his own thoughts. And we do, I think, see in those appointments, those would not necessarily be Bannon's picks. Yeah.
That's David Vondrelli, an editor at large for Time magazine. His latest story, the cover story, looks into Steve Bannon's power in the Trump White House. David, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for reading.
So there's this football game on Sunday, Super Bowl 51 or something like that. The Atlanta Falcons will go up against the New England Patriots in Houston. Yesterday, we looked at the road Falcons quarterback Matt Ryan took to get to this, his first Super Bowl. But you need an atlas for Pat QB Tom Brady. This will be his seventh trip to the big game. Shira Springer from Here and Now contributor WBUR has our story on Tom Brady's drive for ring number 5.
Want to know a secret about Tom Brady? Ask his dad.
He's got a countdown clock in his gym that is now that's ticking to next year's Super Bowl.
That's Tom Brady Sr. talking about a countdown clock his son started about a year ago. The timepiece is a glimpse into the focus, drive, and preparation that make his son arguably the best NFL quarterback ever. For Tom Brady Jr., it's all about winning Super Bowls.
My favorite, always the next one has been my favorite one.
Tom Brady grew up in a tight-knit athletic family, one that honed his competitiveness and drive. The family's closeness has been evident during Super Bowl week. Brady teared up talking about his father, and it's come out that his mother isn't well.
You just have different things that your family goes through in the course of your life, and it's been a challenging year for, my family, just for some personal reasons. It'd just be nice to have everyone here watching us this weekend.
The family watched Brady fight his way up quarterback depth charts in high school, then at the University of Michigan, then with the Patriots. After 17 seasons, Brady is now the superstar with the supermodel wife, the sixth-round pick who, along with Coach Bill Belichick, built an NFL dynasty. Along the way, Brady's inspired both love and hate among fans and opponents.
Success breeds jealousy. Think about it. You're talking about a player that's been to the Super Bowl, like 50% of his career.
That's former Brady teammate Damian Woody, with perhaps the most charitable explanation of why Brady's not more universally adored. But there's more to it than that, like Brady's relationship with President Donald Trump.
I have called him. Sometimes he calls me, sometimes I call him.
It all started with a bright red Make America Great Again cap that Brady had in his locker. And it's made for some awkward moments during the Patriots' current playoff run. Even some Patriots fans took offense at Brady going red in the bluest of blue states. Asked by sports radio WEEI if he congratulated the new president on his election win, Brady had this to say.
For 16 years, someone, before, maybe he was in the position that he was in. He's been very supportive of me for, a long time. So it's just a friendship, and I got a lot of friends, so I call a lot of people.
And then there's Deflategate. Brady's alleged deflating of footballs in a playoff game cost him a 4-game suspension at the start of this season, and it earned him a cheater label. NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell handed down the punishment and instantly became public enemy number one among Pats fans who considered the Deflategate affair a witch hunt. When asked by reporters if the Deflategate fallout provides extra motivation to win a fifth ring, Brady is as calm and composed as he is on the field.
You know, I'm motivated for my teammates. I said that after the game. I think they're all the motivation that I need. And, you know, it takes a lot of work to get to this point. And nothing that's happened in the past, you know, is going to help us win this game.
Damian Woody says it's all a long way from where Brady's NFL career began.
So for me, I saw this tall, lanky kid, didn't really have a lot of muscle build. You really didn't know what to expect at that time.
But it didn't take long to win the respect and trust of his teammates.
I just remember Brady coming into the huddle just so calm.
Woody recalls the game-winning drive in Super Bowl 36 against the St. Louis Rams. Brady had earned the starting QB job just a few months earlier.
You're in the biggest stage of your life, and for him to be that calm, it just brought a calmness to the whole huddle, and we just methodically went down the field. It was almost like he was born for that moment.
Brady's play in that game earned him the first of four Super Bowl rings and the first of three Super Bowl MVP awards. Brady also has two league MVP awards and has won more playoff games than any other quarterback. Fans see it as a testament to both Brady's talent and longevity. The 39-year-old follows a strict diet that bans sugar, white flour, MSG, dairy, and caffeine. Sports Illustrated's Tim Layden says Brady's just as strict and disciplined with his training.
He's never taken his foot off the gas, and maybe he just likes winning, but I think he also likes continuing to prove to people that he's better than some people thought he was at one time. And of course, now in 2017, he has the windmill to tilt at of Roger Goodell having taken four games away from him and Brady thinking that that was unjust. And that's given him another cause to battle.
And given us another reason to wonder just what might happen if the Pats win Super Bowl 51 and Roger Goodell and Tom Brady have to share a stage during the post-game trophy ceremonies. For Here and Now, I'm Shira Springer in Houston.
So we talked today with our friends at WABE in Atlanta, where I learned, Jeremy, it's still illegal to tie your giraffe to a telephone pole in Atlanta. But here's our challenge. If Atlanta wins, public radio in Georgia gets clam chowder. If Boston wins, we demand a crate of peaches. How's that? I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.